Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-1269 et al. Caterpillar Inc. Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Torres for petitioner, Ms. Lancia for respondent.
May it please the court.
Morning.
Good morning. I will first address this court's questions concerning jurisdiction under 10E in this case. As this court has held, the purpose of 10E is notice, specifically to allow the board the opportunity to consider the merits of the issues that are being urged on review. That purpose has been fulfilled in this case. Caterpillar prevailed before the administrative law judge in this case, who found that the company's unilateral action was taken pursuant to an established past practice and was not substantial or material change. The general counsel's exceptions apprised the board of its objections to those findings, which are the same issues that are now in review before this court. This complied with Section 10E's requirements that an objection first be urged before the board. There is no statutory requirement that the objection be urged below by the aggrieved party. This is a reasonable statutory construction in cases such as this, where the aggrieved party prevailed before the administrative law judge, and the board reverses the administrative law judge without introducing any new issues or remedies in its decision. Caterpillar has not found any decisions of this court applying 10E in this same factual context. However, the Seventh and Ninth Circuit have considered this fact pattern and concluded that there was no 10E bar to the appeal. And that's GCIU versus NLRB 572 Fed 3rd 342 and Gardner Mechanical versus NLRB 115-636, which was a Ninth Circuit decision. In addition, Caterpillar was not required by the text of 10E to renew its objection after the board issued its decision in order to exhaust its administrative remedies. Decisions of the Supreme Court and decisions of this court that require a motion to reconsider in order to comply.
Remind me, you did try to file a response to the general counsel's exceptions. It was just late, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you didn't file any motion to overturn, any motion to reconsider the board's overturning of the ALJ, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the decisions of this court and the Supreme Court that have required motions to reconsider in order to satisfy 10E arise in a factually distinct context. For example, in the Wolke decision in the Supreme Court, the board in that case reviewed a case on a stipulated record, and it resolved the case on an issue that neither party had urged below. And in that context, the Supreme Court held that you had to file a motion to reconsider. Similarly, in this court's decision in Flying Food Group, 471 Fed 3rd 178, this court held that motions to reconsider were required in order to satisfy 10E in the circumstances where the petitioner objects to a finding on an issue raised in the decision of the board rather than the ALJ. The board's decision in this case shows that it was fully aware of the arguments presented below by both Caterpillar and the general counsel on the issues currently before this court.
The board 10E uses the phrase by the board, its member, agent, or agency, right? So
yes.
So is the ALJ the agent? Is that the argument? Or?
It certainly is. As it relates to the general counsel's objections, Your Honor, we would submit that they were made directly to the board. As it relates to the Caterpillar's evidence, it certainly was made to the agent, and the board specifically acknowledges Caterpillar's evidence. It specifically acknowledges the cases that it used to argue those points to the administrative law judge. So
is there authority that identifies the ALJ as an agent of the board?
I didn't find any 10E authority that recognized the ALJ as the agent, Your Honor. But again, we would contend that there was, if you will, dual satisfaction here, that insofar as we urge those objections to the administrative law judge and the general counsel urged the same objections on the same issues.
They weren't objections when you were urging them. They were issues, right? I mean, Taney talks about objections. And when
that's a fair point.
Case before the ALJ wasn't comprised of objections, right? I mean, Taney's talking about appealing something.
That's a fair point, Your Honor. Again, we didn't find any cases specifically delineating the purpose of objection. There are cases that look to the administrative law judge decision and the briefs below as whether or not the issues were presented. The more uncontroversial issue here is that the general counsel certainly urged objections to the board's decision on the same issues that were before this court now. There's no question that the board did not purport to issue a new rule in this case. He simply considered the ALJ's objections, decision, and before this court, Caterpillar is only addressing the board's reasoning related to its resolution of the general counsel's exceptions. Accordingly, the recognition of jurisdiction in this factual context is consistent with the statutory language as well as the purpose of 10E.
I'm going to go on to the merits.
I'm sorry?
You want to say something about the merits?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. With respect to the merits of this case, we would submit that the board's past practice analysis, which it used to overturn the administrative law judge, is entitled to no deference because it is in conflict with its own precedent. The evidence in this case shows that in the 7 years before the institution of the Generic First program, Caterpillar unilaterally implemented 3 related changes to its prescription drug program. Each change regulated how and when certain drugs could be obtained. Each change applied to all plan participants.
We review this for abuse of discretion, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what's the argument? I mean, even if we think you're right, what's the argument for the proposition that the board wasn't just wrong but abused its discretion in reaching the opposite conclusion?
Your Honor, as we argued in our briefs, there are a number of board decisions where they found past practices that involved similar types of changes occurring at the same variance in type and regularity, occurring over shorter periods of time that are at issue in this case, and found that those constituted an established past practice. The board is not free to disregard that precedent without either.
Talking about the Post-Tribune case?
Among others, Your Honor, yes.
Well, but in that case, there was a established methodology at work.
Yes, Your Honor.
And here there isn't.
The Post-Tribune case we cited for the question of frequency, in that case, they had made 2 changes in the prior years, and the board found that to be a consistent established past practice. As it relates to similarity, Your Honor.
It was pursuant to a clear methodology that drove the result of the challenged action, whereas here there isn't. There's no predictive. The board found there was no predictable pattern in the earlier actions.
Yes, Your Honor, but if you look at the Courier Journal case, I think you see that the board in that case found that a whole variety of changes to health benefits, from changes in premiums, coverage modifications, provider substitutions, changes to plan year, introduction of separate dental and vision plans, termination of bonuses for employees who waive coverage, all were sufficiently similar in terms of categorical changes to support a past practice finding. The board in that case said that this disparate menu of changes showed that the employer regularly made changes in the cost and benefits of the employee's health care program. And so we would submit that insofar as the board applies a similarity prong in its analysis under Courier Journal, the changes in this case were no more disparate than the changes that the board in Courier Journal found sufficient to establish a past practice. These cases, Courier Journal in particular, involve the same level of predictability and evidentiary support that was established in this case. And the board is certainly free to abandon that precedent, Your Honor, but it must do so.
If we don't agree with you about that, do you want to say something quick about whether it was material or substantial?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the question of materiality, the board offers this court no evidence that there was actually any harm in as to the change that was affected here. And insofar as there was an impact on employees, we would submit that there was no different an impact on employees with respect to this change.
I don't understand that. I assume the company introduced this new plan in order to have an impact. Wasn't the purpose of it to discourage the use of brand drugs?
Yes, Your Honor. But
then if it works the way it's supposed to, it's going to do that, right?
Just as any other restriction on a prescription drug plan will have an impact on employees, that's correct, Your Honor. The question is whether
that's the point?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the point? The point is that before this plan was adopted, they could get brand drugs simply by paying the copay, and now they have to pay full retail. And I assume, in fact, the Caterpillar said it was introducing it because under the old plan, people were still using brand drugs. And wasn't the purpose of this to discourage that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay,
but
so there's your impact. I don't understand that.
The question of impact, Your Honor, can't be viewed in a vacuum, respectfully. The prior changes certainly had impacts on employees as well. If they wanted to obtain certain drugs without pre-authorization, there was an impact on their ability to do that when the first change was put in place. Mm-hmm. When there were quantity limits put on prescription drugs, there was an impact on the employees' access.
Are you suggesting that a generic is indistinguishable from a brand name drug?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that at all. All I'm suggesting is that in each instance, the manner in which drugs were dispensed by a prescribing doctor was impacted by these various changes in the same way that the generic...
Is the issue impact or the materiality of the impact?
Well, our view, Your Honor, is that if there's an established past practice and it has...
My question was, assuming we don't agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Assuming you don't agree with that, Your Honor, we would suggest that the materiality here was not significant because it only applied in those circumstances where employees...
It was 5% of the employees, right?
5% of the employees had at some point used a name brand in lieu of a generic.
So 5% of the employees were going to have to approach the prescription drug benefit in a different way than before, right?
Well, that was all plan participants, Your Honor, and the evidence here was that the employees represented by this union had not brought any such issues to the union's attention as to somehow being harmed by the substitution of these benefits.
I want to ask the board made a point, I recall it, that whatever the past practices were, this was different because this generic first program altered the express terms of the prescription benefit, whereas the others didn't. They either filled in a gap or were in fact within the employer's discretion anyway.
Your Honor, I think every instance here where you exceed the terms of the prescription drug plan, you run the risk of having to pay full price, and that was no different for someone who didn't want to follow the quantity limits or didn't want to get pre-authorization or didn't want to undergo step therapy. If you didn't follow the terms of the plan, just like in this instance, you'll pay a higher amount. So if that's what the board's suggesting, that the terms of the plan were altered, we would submit that effect was no different in this case than in the prior instances. There was no specific alteration of what the copays were. I see I've exceeded my time. If there's
thank you. We'll hear from the NLRB.
May it please the Court. My name is Nicole Lancia, and I represent the National Labor Relations Board in this action to enforce the Board's order, finding that Caterpillar unilaterally announced and implemented Generic First, which unlawfully increased employee copayments for brand-name prescription drugs.
Does the Board think we have jurisdiction?
On the issues that the Board specifically made findings on, specifically past practice and material substantial significant, yes, this court would have jurisdiction because they were properly raised before the Board. Uh-huh. But as to any arguments that might pertain to whether the Board unlawfully rejected the untimely documents submitted by the company or the arguments actually raised within those documents, 10E jurisdictionally would deprive the court of the ability to consider those arguments.
Okay.
So if there are no further questions on the 10E matter, I would like to just make a few points on the two main elements of the Board's findings, past practice and material substantial and significant. Generally, under Section 85 of the Act, an employer will violate Section 85 if it makes material, substantial, and significant changes in existing terms and conditions of employment, such as health care benefits, unless the employer meets its burden of proving that change continued a past practice and thus did not alter the status quo. And the Board correctly found in this case that the company failed to establish a past practice.
This was just an extension of the step therapy policy, right?
No, they were completely different.
How so?
Well, as the company's labor relations consultant testified, Generic First was not a step therapy, though they mistakenly referred to it as such in the letters notifying employees and physicians of the change.
Well, I mean, no, I know it's not the same. It's a different policy, but it's of the same family. Right, it's the same idea.
No, Your Honor. Step therapy was actually more limited in scope. It only applied to certain families of drugs and required employees to first try over-the-counter drugs, and if that proved ineffective, then try generic and brand-name drugs, respectively. However, this was not just about certain families of drugs or certain drugs. This was to all.
If it were more than just limited to the families, wouldn't you acknowledge that it's a lot like the program that they're challenging now?
Well, according to the testimony submitted by the company, it seems that that's what differentiated Generic First from a step therapy, is because Generic First was so much broader in scope. But also, step therapy was not mentioned in the group insurance plans that were negotiated coextensively with the collective bargaining agreement.
Isn't it also different because under step therapy, you couldn't use a brand drug without first trying a generic, right?
Yes.
Whereas under this plan, you can if you're willing to pay for it or if a doctor prescribes it, right?
Yes, and if the doctor orders no substitution, yes.
Right. Okay.
So with respect to past practice, to meet its burden, the employer must demonstrate the regularity and frequency of the past changes such that the new change that it unilaterally implemented is something that employees could have reasonably expected to continue on a regular and consistent basis. And because the testimony fails to establish how often the prior changes occurred, other than the fact that there were three types of changes, and the circumstances surrounding the implementation of those changes as compared with Generic First, there is no inference and no evidence of regularity or frequency.
What does that mean, how often they occurred? I didn't understand that. I know the board did say it, but what does it mean?
Well, because regularity and frequency are components of demonstrating past practice.
If the company institutes a change in the group health program, as it did with this step business, it does it once, doesn't it? What is the regularity and frequency? That's one massive change.
With respect to this case, what's interesting is that the company, in my understanding, was arguing that its practice of making changes to the prescription plan itself allowed it, was the past practice, and allowed it to implement yet another change to the prescription drug plan.
Right.
So if those past changes, in order to constitute a practice, allowing the company to add another change as a continuation of that practice, those past changes would have needed to be regular and frequent to the point where they wouldn't have altered employees' existing terms and conditions of employment, and thus employees could have reasonably expected another change like those.
Three times in 7 years. That's.
But under the board's case law, all we know in this case, based on the facts, is that pre-authorization requirements were implemented in 1998 for one drug, Celebrex, and quantity limits were implemented in 1999 and 2006 for two other drugs, and possibly more than one was implemented, according to the labor relations consultant, but he didn't want to hazard a guess on that matter. He also didn't want to hazard a guess on how many step therapies were implemented, but he was sure that there was definitely more than one. And as I was explaining under the board's precedent in, for example, Courier Journal, where you have consecutive years of implementing increased employee contributions for insurance premiums, it was 1992,
93, 94. I understand now that it's for how many step therapies? Was that by the condition that the drugs were designed to alleviate? Or was it by the name of the drug?
It was families of drugs. So I think the specific family related to like cholesterol type drugs, like Prilosec, OTC.
There's an over the counter for cholesterol?
Well, I think now that's what it's called. But I think it was Prilosec in terms of the step therapy. But it was a certain family of drugs. So certain drugs that treat only one condition, arguably, whereas Generic First was for any brand name drug that had a generic equivalent. If the court would like, I can move on to explaining the material, substantial, and significant standard, or?
Yeah, is there a difference between, is there any kind, does, Is the generic always the same as the brand name?
Not to my knowledge, and there's nothing in the record to suggest one way or another that they're the same or that they're different.
That, they have that there's no difference in the effect of the drug? If that were true, right, then how could this be a material change?
A material, substantial, and significant change under board law has been defined by what alters employee expectations or entitlements.
You're getting the same thing, if in fact the premise is correct. I don't know if it's correct, but...
Yeah, I am unsure as well, Your Honor, but given that in the 2005 group insurance plans, it said $5 for generic or $20 or $35 for brand name, regardless of whether the doctor orders no substitution or not. There were set express prices for brand name drugs. However, here, now as a result of this increased cost from $20 or $35 to full retail price, that results also in an impairment in employees' discretion in being able to use their bargain for negotiated benefits that were obviously obtained by the union, which they elected to represent them and thought would be effective in doing so. And by the company failing to bargain with the union before implementing this change, it demonstrates to employees that they cannot expect the union to fairly represent their interests and that anything that is put down in writing can later be contravened by the company's actions. So just to conclude on that point for material, substantial, and significant, the board precedent demonstrates that consistency in finding that any unilateral change that changes the cost of benefits to employees in contravention of the existing terms and conditions of employment or results in an impairment or loss of employee discretion in using those benefits is a material, substantial, and significant change. And just to make another point with respect to past practice, the board's primary finding with respect to that was that the company did not demonstrate the regularity and frequency of the practice, but it found alternatively, even if it had demonstrated regularity or frequency, and if that was developed in the testimony, as you noted, the changes were not similar enough to even be a practice, let alone of the timing of when they happened. Just because they all affected the prescription drug plan does not suggest that they all affected employees' expectations of what the existing terms and conditions were of employment were at that time. And just a further point on to raise our waiver argument, we understand that in the company's brief they suggest that they were not making directly a waiver argument, suggesting that the union waived their right to bargain over generic first because of those past changes. But we just wanted to remind the court that the import of their argument is to suggest that because the company made prior changes that affected the prescription drug plan, by making those changes and the union not contesting them except for one of them through arbitration in 1999, that enabled the company to be able to implement generic first now, assuming that it does not have to go through the union in order to change employees' benefits.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Torres, I think you're out of time, but you can take 1 minute if you'd like it.
Just to briefly address the last point that counsel made on the question of waiver, we are not contending that there is some prospective future permanent waiver here. The union is certainly free to raise objections about whether future changes can be made, and certainly the company recognizes its obligations under AT to bargain with it. The question here is whether or not the prior changes allowed it to make the change at issue in this case, not whether some future changes or additional developments could cause the union to say, we want to talk to you about changing this practice. So I don't think that that's an issue that needs to trouble the court, because we've not taken the position that there was some permanent prospective waiver. And the only other quick point I'll make is that the general counsel's argument about the board's argument about similarity just can't be squared with Courier Journal. The changes there were certainly more, if not the same, more disparate than the changes that were made in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted.